great pleasure of welcoming on SBS French, Tony Magnati. Welcome, bonjour.
Bonjour, nice to be back on SBS radio again.
Excellent. You've got this exhibition coming of photos taken in Paris in 2020. It's at the height of the pandemic, and the exhibition is called Our Hearts Are Still Open, and it's going to be at the Kirribilli Centre Gallery in Sydney until the 5th of December. What can you tell us about the photos, the life of the French people you've captured on camera?
Well, I guess the place to start is why I went to Paris last year. The beginning of last year, I decided to try perhaps to live in France permanently. And unfortunately, COVID followed me from Australia, from the side of the world. About a week after I arrived in Paris, it really hit. And so my plans were upended, like everybody's. And I gradually began to see that there was a story on the streets of Paris that wasn't being told. Every night the news was full of crisis and chaos and death and, you know, the very dark side of the pandemic, of course, as you'd expect. But I wanted to record and document a certain kind of attitude that the French seemed to be adopting, which was one of perseverance, of a spirit of community, not letting this defeat them, and also a very unusual thing, which was that Paris was devoid, completely devoid of tourists. Now, as you know, Paris is one of the two or three greatest tourist destinations in the world. There are always thousands and thousands of tourists any time of the year, summer, winter, anytime. There was nobody. There was nobody. And this came home to me very strongly one day. I was in the Quai d'Orsay Musée, and I went upstairs into the room full of Gauguin, and I was the only person there for about 20 minutes. And this was an opportunity which will never happen again. Normally, there are, of course, hundreds of tourists. So the streets were devoid of tourists and also devoid of a lot of traffic. And it suddenly started to look like Paris would have been in the 1950s after the war. And naturally, my mind went back to the great photographers of that era, people like Cartier-Bresson, Robert Doisneau, Willy Ronis. I could see that if I captured that spirit, it might be reminiscent of a period when, again, the French people were forced to band together to rebuild a country, to save the country, really. And so there was some of that spirit in what I was trying to achieve. I think I also was determined to find a level of optimism and not play on the gloom and the doom of COVID. And somehow, as part of my natural instinct, I wanted to introduce some irony and a little bit of humor even into the situation.
And Tony, you mentioned Cartier-Bresson and Doisneau before. Are they kind of your mentors, source of inspiration?
I think so, yes. I mean, you're very wary of saying, oh, you know, I love Cartier-Bresson, because it sounds like a cliche. But for me, it was a very seminal introduction to photography. When I was a teenager in Brisbane, there was a magazine, a British magazine called Creative Camera. It no longer exists. But it was the first magazine in English to start showing the work of these post-war French photographers, Doisneau, Cartier-Bresson, Willy Ronis, Martin Frank, a lot of the best. And I saw this in black and white in this magazine, and you could imagine the impact it had on me as a teenager in Brisbane in the 1960s, 70s. I was captivated. And when I fortunately joined the ABC at a very young age as a trainee journalist, the first thing I did was to buy a secondhand Leica camera. I suppose I was trying to, in a sense, emulate these gods. And I started shooting on the streets of Brisbane and then subsequently Sydney. And then everywhere I traveled as a journalist for the next 30 or 40 years, I was always out there with my Leica. Unfortunately, one day in Rio de Janeiro, I lost my Leica to someone with a gun who insisted on taking it from me, and I didn't argue. But I've subsequently replaced it, of course. But these great French photographers really set the standard, and also the spirit of a humanist photography, a photography that isn't about shock or anger or splashy colors or whatever, just trying to capture ordinary people living their lives, but with great beauty and great composition, great style. And so these were the elements that stayed with me. And I was really playing with those elements last year in Paris.
And tell us about the Kiribilli Center Gallery, where the exhibition is going to happen.
Yeah, it's a very interesting place. It's just over the Harbour Bridge on the North Shore, and it's a beautiful old sandstone mansion from the 1880s. And the top floor has been converted into a lovely gallery, which overlooks the harbour. So I couldn't be happier with the space. We're about to go and hang the show, 25 large images. And I can't wait to see what they look like on the wall collectively. It's always a great moment for a photographer to see the gallery show come together. And on Sunday, we're having the official opening. It's part of the Head On Photo Festival, which is one of the biggest festivals in Australia, if not the world now. It's been going for 15 years. And it's being opened by the director of that festival, Moshe Rosendeck. So we're hoping that'll be a very exciting event, and it'll be up for 3 weeks. So anyone in Sydney who's got the opportunity, drop by and please have a look.
And Tony, at the beginning of this interview, you said you were very happy to come back to SBS. So tell us about your life as a journalist, as SBS European correspondent, I believe.
Yeah, well, I joined the ABC when I was 18 years old, which is pretty much impossible now. As a cadet journalist, great opportunity for a kid from Brisbane. Mm. And I very quickly was drawn to international reporting. I went to London for a while. I worked with Reuters Television. I came back to the ABC as editorial chief of the international desk. And I went to East Timor, covered the fighting there, tragic story. And at some point, I actually wanted to get away from journalism. I'd been doing so much of it. And I really wanted to write novels, take photographs, be more creative, I guess, in a personal sense. And when I wrote my second novel, I was given a bourse, a grant to go to the Cité des Arts Internationale in Paris for 6 months in 1989. So I accepted that, and it was a great moment for 6 months to live in Paris, 30 years ago this is. And what happened then, of course, was totally unexpected, was that the world pretty much started to collapse, the world we knew. The Berlin Wall fell down, communism collapsed in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union imploded. These were great moments. And SBS said for Dateline, would you like to stay in Europe and be our correspondent? Well, what an opportunity for me, of course. So I lived in Paris for 2 or 3 years. There were heady days, particularly in France. Mitterrand was the president and a very powerful figure, as you know, of course, dynamic and I guess a towering figure, literally. And Europe was going through a great upheaval. I mean, it was a new Europe. It was a Europe that was, on the one hand, dynamic and exciting, but also confronted with a whole new reality post the Cold War. So the stories were endless. We covered mainly issues that would interest Australian and particularly SBS audiences, like immigration was a big one. The rise of right-wing politics. We covered stories around the Liga Nord in Italy and other movements, which have, you know, now coalesced into serious political forces. The shift to the right generally was almost starting to happen then, even though it seemed that that would never have a great impact on Europe. But we see now, after 30 years, how gradually that has happened to become a powerful force. So they were terrific times. I had a strange period in Paris because, although I say I lived in Paris for 3 years, I was hardly ever in Paris because I was covering Europe, of course. And in those days, this is pre-digital, pre-internet, we shot everything on videotape, literally on tape. And so when we shot a story in Eastern Europe, we would end up with 30 or 40 or 100 tapes, which had to be edited. And it was actually cheaper for SBS to fly me back to Australia and edit in the studios in SBS than to edit in Paris. So I was going backwards and forwards about 3 or 4 times a year. I clocked up a lot of air miles, probably burned a lot of carbon when you think about that. But they were very exciting times. And I came back in 1992, and I then went to the film and television school for a year doing screenwriting. I tried to escape journalism, and then one day the ABC rang and said, would you like to be the executive producer of the 7:30 report? Again, an opportunity very hard to turn down. So I did that for another few years. And that's really my story. But in the background of all of this, I've always been carrying the camera, taking photographs, publishing them, and capturing that sort of change in life that we've seen. You know, this 30-year stretch from the early 90s to now has been an extraordinary period of turmoil in the world. And you see it on the streets. You see it in the way people behave. You see all of these things. So I try to capture some of that mood all the time. And of course, it was heightened by COVID enormously. And in Paris, it was very special. You know, it was an extraordinary stroke of luck that I guess I happened to be in Paris at that time.
And Tony, you mentioned before that you were in East Timor as a television journalist in, I think it was 1975.
Correct, yeah.
And as we speak today, it's the 11th of November, so Remembrance Day. And 5 of your colleagues from 7 and 9 News were killed by the Indonesian army. What is your recollection of what happened? What is your message today on the 11th of November?
Well, that was not to put too much on it, but it was the defining moment of my professional life in a very dark way, of course. I was sent to Timor by ABC News to cover the story, and we didn't really expect the events to unfold as dramatically as they did. We'd been there a couple of weeks, and then we went up to the border to Balabo, a very famous name now, but back then just another village on the border. And we began filming, but we were shelled with artillery. And I think the Indonesians realized that there was TV coverage there, and they wanted us away because they really wanted to take over that territory. And so we were pulling back with the troops at the time, and we met the Channel 7 and Channel 9 crews. They insisted on going up to the border despite, you know, the problems we'd had. I suggested they should wait, but they didn't. And they took that risk. And unfortunately, 4 days later, the Indonesians did invade over that border. And my colleagues attempted to film the invasion and were brutally murdered. And that's been confirmed by coroner's inquiries and many other reports. So for me, it was very difficult at that point. I was still pretty much the only Australian journalist in East Timor, and I had to keep reporting this war, but they were threatening to kill me too. And it's a terrible dilemma for any foreign correspondent, to war correspondent, to decide whether to stay or whether to go. You know, on the one hand, you don't want to abandon the story, you don't want to abandon the people who need their story to be told, but you don't want to get killed. And even if you were that heroic and you got killed, it would serve no useful purpose because you couldn't report, you know. So it's a terrible catch-22 situation where you have to make a decision. And I stayed on for several weeks, but every day I realized that if the Indonesians arrived completely, they would kill me. they said they would, and they would. And so I made a decision to leave. But it was a very, very dark period of my life. Today, all these years later, I still think about it constantly, once a week, twice a week. It's never left my mind. It inspired me to help form a group called the International News Safety Group, where we try to train journalists how to operate in hostile environments. We try to ensure that there is prosecution of people who kill journalists, and the number of journalists killed would frighten most listeners. It's something like 20 every year, at least. Constantly, you're at risk as a journalist in those places of being killed, deliberately killed, not just accidentally killed, but deliberately killed, because you're the truth gatherer, and you know people know that. And what's the best way to stop the truth getting out is to shoot the messenger, to kill the journalist. So it's something I think about a lot, and I worry all the time. I was teaching at the UTS University in Sydney. I was teaching international journalism, and some of my graduate students went off to war zones, and I encouraged them to think carefully about going, but it's very hard to stop young, enthusiastic journalists. And I worry terribly that one day I'd get bad news about them. So far, so good, but it's always a worry. And yet, we must do it. We must do it, because without these independent observers, without these truth tellers, then the whole situation collapses terribly.
Tony, we come back to your exhibition. I remind the listeners, it's on at the Kirribilli Centre Gallery until the 5th of December, and it's called Our Hearts Are Still Open. And in the media release, I noted that I think one morning you left the local boulangerie, and the owner said to you, the bars and the cafes are closed, but our hearts are still open.
Yes. And I was thinking about a book, and I was thinking about an exhibition. This was in the summertime last year. Paris was always deserted because of COVID, but even more so because people had left to go on some kind of holiday if they could. So when the lady at the boulangerie said the cafes are closed but our hearts are still open, I thought I have to use that title. That's just too good. Yeah, our hearts are still open, because that's exactly what I was trying to achieve: a sense of we're not going to give in. We're going to keep the high levels of compassion, of empathy, look after each other, and I think in general the French did that remarkably well. I mean, there was no sense of real panic that one might have expected when, as we know, up to 1,000, 1,500 people a day were dying. I mean, this was an extraordinary event. But people kept their calm. They looked after each other. They kept up their spirits, and even found room to laugh. You know, I mean, that's the nature of the French mind. I love that about the French people. They're not people who give in lightly. And they've seen a lot of struggles, and I'm not just talking about the war and the occupation. I'm talking about this century. You know, the level of terrorism in Paris, urban terrorism, has been frightening, and the loss of young people, especially, is really disturbing in these events. But nevertheless, you know, COVID brought people together, and so that's the spirit I've tried to reflect in the photographs and in the book. The book is an interesting development, because I thought I'd just bring out a book of photographs with a visual portrayal of COVID in Paris. But I talked to this philosopher, Raymond Gaita, very well-known philosopher in Australia. He wrote a wonderful memoir called Romulus, My Father, which that was made into a successful film. Anyway, Raymond said, let me write a bigger essay for the book. And he wrote this wonderful essay about humanity and what it meant to be alive in the 21st century. How do we express ourselves as human beings? And he related that not only to COVID, but to places, what he called great cities like Paris, where there's this enormous depth of history and culture that is it's without any measure in history. We've never had cities like this, that big, that deeply cultured. Berlin might be a place like that, maybe New York, but Paris, to me and to most people, summarizes the human creative spirit. And so he wrote this essay, and it suddenly became a metaphor, not only for the Paris, not only for France, but for the world. And so it made me look at the photographs again in a much broader perspective, the idea that the photographs didn't only represent the Parisians and the French, but in fact, all of us tied together by this sense of a common humanity, which really is, I think, the great lesson of COVID. If we don't see it as a lesson, if we just think it's now back to normal, business as usual, then we've lost something. We should learn something from the COVID experience. And the biggest lesson, I think, is the idea that we have to look after each other and we have to look after the planet. This is the only opportunity we have to go forward. So that's what I hope is in the book, and that's what I hope is in the exhibition.
Tony Magnatti, thank you so much for coming on to SBS French, and as we say in good English, bonne continuation.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you so much. Au revoir.